This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A banner day yesterday in Vancouver, the best single day ever for the U.S. at the Winter Olympic Games. 6 medals in all, including an unprecedented second consecutive gold in the men's 1,000 meters for speed skater Shawnee Davis, Sean White's second consecutive gold in the men's halfpipe, and a 1-2 finish in the women's downhill for Lindsey Vonn and Julia Mancuso. One of the glamour events is up tonight, the decisive long program for the male figure skaters. The hockey tournaments are well underway. Host Canada has won its first gold, and it did that early on. But these games will also forever be associated with the death of a Georgian slider on the luge course, and concern that pursuit of higher, faster, stronger overrides safety at the Winter Games. Almost halfway through, what's your biggest moment or biggest complaint about the games thus far? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We begin in Vancouver with NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. Tom, nice to have you back.
Greetings from sunny and cold Vancouver, Neil.
Well, cold, that's a change.
It's a real Winter Olympics now.
Well, congratulations on that. Tom, one of the big moments thus far had to come on the medal stand last night when Shawnee Davis celebrated with his once bitter rival Chad Hedrick, a surprise bronze medal winner in the 1,000 meters.
Not sure how bitter it was. I mean, they definitely feuded, but you know how thousands of journalists like to take a story and run with it?
Sure.
There was a little bad blood between the two, but yes, last night was significant, not just for Shawnee Davis winning his second consecutive gold medal in the same event, becoming at that point the third man in Winter Olympic history to do that from the United States, but it was this this olive branch with Chad Hedrick, how they both grabbed the flag and held it up, and both of them were so conciliatory afterwards in comments that they made. Shawnee Davis, who was known as kind of a dour guy in Turin because he just really didn't like the treatment he was getting from the media, he was all smiles last night. There were a few kind of provocative questions. One of them, why did he drop out of the 500 meters earlier in the week? Well, he did it to rest up for the 1,000, and it paid off. But he handled all that with aplomb, and so it was. It was a good night for long track speed skating, which was very important because they did so well. Hedrick and Davis won 5 medals altogether in Torino, and they're two of the best skaters. Speed skaters. In the world, but that was really kind of overshadowed by what happened with their off the ice stuff in 06.
Nice quote from Shawnee Davis last night. It's my party. I can celebrate. I can dance. I can do whatever I want. I earned it, and he certainly did.
He did, yeah.
And, of course, there is plenty more to come. There is the men's figure skating tonight, the long program, and Americans seem pretty well positioned there, too.
One of them, at least. It is going to be fabulous. I mean, all the experts who know about this a lot better than I do say this is the deepest field ever. You've got Evgeny Plyshenko, the defending Olympic champion, who looks on form, even though he retired and was out of competition for a good over 3 years. Evan Lysacek from the U.S. is in second place by just fractions of a point. He's the reigning world champion. Then you've got Daisuke Takahashi, who many people believe was the best skater in the short program. It was just a dynamic program. He's a silver medalist at a former world championship and could become the first Japanese male to win an Olympic medal in men's figure skating. Japan, I should note, did really well. They've currently got skaters in third, fourth, and eighth position. So they've really kind of exploded on the scene here. And then you've got a couple former world champion, Brian Joubert, who didn't do well. He's really not in the race. Stefan Lambiel from Switzerland, he's a former world champion, the Olympic silver medalist in 2006. He is an absolutely gorgeous artistic skater. His final spin the other night in the short program, I thought he was going to bore a hole in the ice. It was just intense, and it brought the crowd to its feet. And then, of course, you've got Johnny Weir, who's sitting in sixth place, and who knows what costume he'll be wearing tonight. And then the home country favorite, Patrick Chan of Canada, didn't do very well in the short program. Not a real serious contender at this point, but there'll be lots of cheering for him. So incredibly deep field.
Well, more about those costumes a bit later in the program.
You bet.
It was a great day also for American women alpine skiers. Howard Berkus is following that story. He also joins us from Vancouver. Howard, nice to have you with us.
I'm actually in Whistler, Neil.
In Whistler. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, that's where they're skiing. And it's also beautiful here, which is a very pleasant change. You know, it was heavy snow, heavy rain, fog, you know, for so many days, but it cleared up yesterday for that that grand downhill race that saw history being made for American women, Julia Mancuso with the silver and Lindsey Vonn, of course, for the gold.
And after, as you mentioned, so many days of concern, not only about the condition of the course, but about the condition of Lindsey Vonn's shin.
Oh, yeah. You know, and we just talked to Lindsey Vonn. She was skiing this morning in the downhill portion of the Super Combine, and as she came out of the finish area, she stopped and talked to reporters. And we asked her how her shin was, and she says it's not good. It's really hurting. She's really struggling with it. She said it's definitely the most pain it's been since she started skiing on it. She still got to ski this afternoon in the slalom portion, which will not, you know, which should be painful on that leg, because the slalom requires a lot of shifting through gates, and that'll put pressure on that leg. She'll have a day of rest tomorrow before the Super G the next day, but she's basically saying that she's in as much pain as she has been with this leg. And in fact, she limped away from the media area and climbed over a 4-foot fence. It looked to me like so she could ski out of that area instead of having to walk out in pain.
Interesting stories also about the really lifelong rivalry between she and the silver medal winner Mancuso.
Julia Mancuso has also suffered some injuries. They talked today. They both talked today about how happy they were that each other was doing well. Julia Mancuso, you know, finished for that silver yesterday. She's still in the running today, although the slalom portion of this event that's coming up later today is not exactly her strength. Same for really Lindsey Vonn. You know, the speed events, the downhill, the all-out, just go out and go as fast as you can kind of events are what she's best at. Although, you know, she wouldn't be atop the World Cup standings if she also couldn't handle herself on the slalom stage.
Yeah, she's got to be able to turn. Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Howard Berkus is with us from Whistler. Tom Goldman with us from Vancouver. What's been the most exciting moment for the games for you, or what are you complaining about? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll start with Karen. Karen's with us from Lynn, Massachusetts.
Hello, I'm so excited to be on.
Well, thanks very much for that.
I'm a huge Winter Olympics fanatic, and I'm a very big ski racing fan. And for me, the coverage has been very disappointing. We get to see, you know, the top Americans, some of the Canadians, but I don't see enough of the large international field. And I know this is often a problem at most of the games when we watch the ski racing, but I was just wondering what your guests had to comment on that.
Well, Howard Berkus, I don't know if you got a chance to see the coverage on NBC that all of us, Karen and I, got to see last night, but she's right. You do get to see the Americans. You get to see the Canadians. You get to see some of the top competitors, the Swiss competitor, for example, who was thought to be a great chance in the downhill yesterday. And if you see anybody else, you almost guarantee that there's going to be a spectacular crash.
Exactly.
We don't get a chance really to see the NBC coverage here because we're not in the United States, and actually we get to see what I think every Olympic fan would really want if it was available to them, which is every single event live without commentary, with raw sound, just the event happening as it happens, and it's really a pleasure to be able to see the Olympics that way, because you do see everyone, you see every moment of drama without interruption. That's probably not commercially viable, so don't count on it coming to your TV screen anytime soon. But we also hear the same complaints, by the way, from some people here in Canada. We do get to see the coverage from the CTV consortium here in Canada, and it's similar, but with the bent towards the Canadian athletes and the athletes who are challenging the Canadians. It's very rah-rah Canadian, and it's what you'd expect. It's sort of the NBC equivalent.
Well, I do remember seeing an Olympics in England when I lived there, and boy, did we see a lot of equestrian events.
the
right,
problem...
And in Australia, there was a heavy emphasis, of course, on the Australians,
sure.
Who were the most fun at the Sydney Olympics, so there was nothing lost there by any means.
Tom?
This is Tom in Vancouver. The problem, Neil, and this is now my ninth Olympics that I've been fortunate enough to be at, and I always say the best part of it is what Howard is saying. You get to see the event. And the problem with this overproduction on television is there's no trust in the innate drama of an event. And all you need to see, you don't even need commentary. I mean, a little background may help, but you could, if you see one skier go, and then you see the next skier, and it just builds and builds, and you look at the person in the finish line, they're looking up the mountain, is this next person going to better my time? Every event here, you know, seeing each athlete go and seeing it build and build and build toward the end, you don't get that when you break away to commercials constantly. I actually did get a feed of NBC one night very early in the morning. I was watching after work, and you know, not just, you know, how they cut away, but not just how they jump around from events, but cutting away immediately to a commercial. You can't even see after an athlete performs kind of their reaction, how it resonates with them, the fans. And so, yeah, complain. We're very fortunate here, and I feel bad for the people who have to watch the other.
Karen, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're talking with NPR's correspondents covering the Winter Olympic Games. Howard Berkus is in Whistler, and he's got to get back to work. So, Howard, we're going to let you go.
All right. Thanks a lot, Neil.
Howard Berkus, NPR correspondent, covering his seventh Olympics. The old man of the group, Tom Goldman, will stay with us. If you'd like to contribute to the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 5 gold medals for the U.S. Olympic team thus far, including wins yesterday by speed skater Shawnee Davis, skier Lindsey Vonn, and snowboarder Shaun White. We're not quite halfway through the Winter Games. Still looming over the excitement, of course, the tragic death of Nodar Kumar Itashvili, the Georgian loser, on a practice run last week, a reminder of just how risky many of these winter sports can be. If you're a winter athlete, has your sport gotten more risky? And what role does danger play in the games on TV? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman is with us from Vancouver. And also joining us now is Vicki Michaelis, head Olympic writer for USA Today, also in Vancouver. And Vicki, nice to have you with us as well.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
And let's go back to that terrible accident on the luge track. There had been complaints before that terrible accident that it was too fast, too dangerous, that things could go easily wrong, and of course, tragically, they did.
There had actually been some testing done, not last season, but the season before, by some of the sport's top athletes. After that testing, the very wall where Kumar Itashvili went off was heightened by a foot and a half. So clearly there were concerns well before the games began.
And is this just an example of, well, every time you build a new luge course, a new bobsled run, it's got to be faster and more dangerous than the one that preceded?
I think there is some pushing of the envelope in terms of the tracks. A lot of the people I talked to, however, said that the tracks have to follow the contour of the mountains. They're doing this with computer modeling now. And so a lot of it is very technical, and there are bounds that you cannot push given the computer modeling and how it's built off of that. Having that said, certainly the sport gets a lot more publicity when people are going at faster speeds and they're setting world record speeds coming down a new track.
And we do have to put this in perspective, the Winter Games being held just after the Daytona 500, and there are an awful lot of sports that are dangerous. Nevertheless, does it seem that the Winter Games are becoming more dangerous?
Well, I think you're going to see an example of that coming up on Sunday. You're going to see the men's ski cross, which is the Olympics' newest event. And much like the snowboarder cross that we saw the last 2 days, you've got competitors coming down the mountain with each other. So not only do you have man versus elements, you now have man versus elements. And anytime you throw another thing in the mix, anything can happen.
Well, as we saw from the success of the short track speed skating, where competitors jostle with each other, and a lot of it is very exciting to watch on TV, is that the genesis of having four competitors coming down the course at one time?
I think a lot of it is. I think it's just it makes it much more spectator-friendly when you have a head-to-head competition as opposed to long track where they skate against the clock and you have to be aware of their times. And maybe it's just not quite as exciting when Shawnee Davis is skating 10th and he's trying to beat someone who skated 2nd and it's not the man next to him.
Right, and you're just watching his race against the clock as opposed to against the man.
Right, exactly. It's just not nearly as exciting. I mean, I've been covering short track here, and I have to tell you, as a reporter, as you know, you're usually pretty distanced from what you're doing. You're just doing your job, but I get really nervous watching these people go around the track.
Well, at least they also have those very big sponge rubber mats that they can fall into after if they slip and fall. And indeed, a lot of athletes say that, the courses may be more dangerous and some of the equipment more dangerous too, but nevertheless, the safety equipment is better.
There is definitely that factor. I mean, if you look at the safety fences they have for the downhill course, for example, the safety fences now are actual safety fences. I think they used to have bamboo sticks or something, you know, maybe 30 years ago. And certainly if you ran into one of those, it wasn't going to stop you.
Tom Goldman, let me bring you into this. How have the athletes been responding to the death of that Georgian and to concerns about safety?
Well, it's obviously the reactions to the Georgian's death were, very extreme and heartfelt. I mean, one of his teammates actually left the Olympics because he said he just, couldn't do it. Everyone knows that it was a tragedy and talks about it being a tragedy, but they keep going, and this is the whole part of the Winter Olympics in particular. These athletes know that they're getting into very dangerous sports, not just the so-called extreme sports like in snowboarding, the X Games types of sports. Lots of very potentially scary and dangerous things. I was watching the pairs figure skating the other day, watching the men hoist the woman up and then doing, footwork on the ice. Well, you catch a toe pick and down everyone goes, and my God, the woman is suspended, in a very vulnerable position. There could be terrible things happening there. But all of these athletes are so good at what they do, you rarely see things like this. But I think, interestingly, Shaun White, who won his gold medal last night in the half pipe with a wonderful performance, he was badly injured in practice during the X Games and hit his face on the lip of the half pipe, and his helmet flew off. It looked horrible. And he said, we fall, we get up, we try again. And I think along with Sidius Altius Fortius, that's pretty much of an Olympic motto for the athletes. They get up and dust themselves off and they keep going and knowing the danger is part of what they do.
But Vicky Michaelis of USA Today, a lot of them also seem to be experts on laparoscopic surgery.
Yes. And that's another thing that is pushing the danger aspect, I think, is that the surgeons are getting better and better at being able to fix them. And so what used to be a career-ending injury is no longer a career-ending injury. They go back out after, having multiple knee rebuilds or what have you. And that allows them to become even more inured to the dangers that they're putting themselves in every day.
Yet you also see someone like Lindsey Vonn yesterday clearly in pain from that shin injury. And part of that great story, and something that is going to be part of her story forever, is soldiering on through the pain.
Well, certainly, journalists probably have to take some blame for this. We make a big thing out of stories like that. Lindsey's story coming into these games was at the last games. She picked herself up after a pretty horrible fall and still skied, finished 8th, I believe. And so we come in with that storyline, and she has this bruised shin now, and we build her up for coming back from that and still skiing with it. And you have 10-year-old girls or boys out there who are skiing, and they see that, and they think, well, if that's what it takes to be famous and that's what it takes to have a great story, what are we doing to their mentality?
Vicky Michaelis, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Vicky Michaelis, head writer for USA Today at the Winter Olympic Games. With us from Vancouver, Tom Goldman, still with us. Let's even get some more callers on the line. Let's go next to Diane. Diane with us from Monroe in Connecticut.
Hi. I have been following the female ski jumping career of Lindsey Vann now for quite a few years. She's a top female in the country, actually in the world. You know, I'd like the panel to discuss what I feel. It's my opinion that they should be allowed to jump in the Olympics. And I think they've met all the requirements. And I don't understand why the IOC keeps turning them down.
Lindsey Vann, not to be confused with Lindsey Vonn, but
right, that's V-A-N-N.
Tom Goldman?
Lindsey Vann would have, I don't know if she would have been as big a star making it on the cover of Sports Illustrated, but had she been here and ski jumped and done well, she would have been a big star too. This is one of those things where the IOC has really blown it. They kind of, when asked and pressed on this, they obfuscated and kind of passed the buck and said, well, it's not as much our decision. And the provincial government in Canada, in British Columbia, and the IOC were kind of falling over themselves to say, well, we can't do this or we can't do that. The essence of it is that some really tremendous female athletes have been left out of the games and not able to compete, and it's really bad. I mean, the way the Olympics wants to reach new audiences, we saw this happening in the Summer Games with the exclusion now of softball. Sports that are popular and sports that where women do so well, it's important to put that forward. And so the IOC has really blown it with these women ski jumpers.
Diane, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Here's an email from Stephen in San Rafael, California. A revelation for me this year has been the biathlon competition. Quite entertaining to watch because of the design of the competition. Frequent lead changes can occur because when a shooter misses a shot, it translates to a time penalty as he or she must ski around a loop one time for each shot missed. Plus, the setting in the mountains is gorgeous. And Tom, that is one of the events that's just great to watch on that raw feed that you do get from the IOC.
It really is. That and cross-country skiing, love seeing those. There's just such kind of quiet endurance going on in that. But the biathlon with a whole different range of skills, not just cross-country skiing, but shooting at a target. And so difficult to do when, you know, you're cross-country skiing, working up, you're getting awfully exhausted doing that. And then you have to come in and steady yourself and hit a target. I actually did a story on this a couple of days ago on one of our programs about the U.S. men's biathlon team, and we're still waiting for them to break out. They had a breakout star this past season on the circuit, on the World Cup circuit, Tim Burke, and he's had some bad luck so far. He and a couple of other of the male biathletes, the first event, a 10-kilometer sprint, there was this kind of freakish snow squall that happened, and every competitor who started after, say, position number 10 was caught in this and really had no chance to kind of make up time and get into a good position. And unfortunately for Tim Burke, he finished, I think it was 47th in that. Mm. Jay Hakkinen, who is a veteran, I think this is his fourth Olympics, he finished in the 50s. And the problem was that your finish in the sprint also determined your start position in the next event, which was a day or two ago. So those guys didn't really have a chance to get to the podium. I feel them wanting ready to bust out in the next event in biathlon and wanting to show that the Americans no longer are an afterthought in the biathlon world. They had already established that on the World Cup circuit, but unless you're into the sport, the general public doesn't see these sports until they get to the Olympics.
Just note, 10-kilometer sprint. Okay, let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Ralph. Ralph with us from Holworth in New Jersey.
Hi,
Ralph.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I picked up on your dialogue there for a moment ago about what NBC shows us and what is really available on television for the Olympics. And having directed a couple of the world broadcasts in '96 at the Atlanta track venue and in '02 the downhill at Salt Lake, the world feed is something that Americans would love. Because it is a pictorial storyline with all the competition round by round, with beautiful slow motion, gorgeous pictures, And it's something that we don't get to see. We get to see, you know, sort of a bunch of talking people in a studio. And for those of us who really, really want to see and appreciate competition in its rawest form, unless we can get that online, or unless, you know, we live in a country that takes the World Feed as a complete production, and there are many countries that do, we're missing out on so much of the beauty and majesty of the Olympics.
Well, let's not be too harsh on people sitting in a studio and talking. Ralph, we appreciate your expertise. Thanks very much for the call. Bye-bye.
You know, Neil, as much as I am dedicated to the audio world, I have to agree with Ralph. This is just an absolute visually stunning event. And as he said, the world feed is just remarkable with these super slow motion close-ups. Mm-hmm. And, phenomenal.
All now in high def?
Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure. Sure looks it.
We're talking with NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman in Vancouver. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another email. This is from Jane in Portland, Oregon. The new generation of American athletes are charming and well-spoken. I'm glad for all of them when they win. I wish our national coverage would learn how to honor athletes who strike gold from other countries. I hate hearing that we earned the most medals ever on a given day. We outperform most countries in the size of our national population by sheer demographic clout. We should actually be doing better than we do, so let's drop the numbers count and go for the stories. How much is the national competition played up there in Vancouver?
Hugely. We've mentioned this on the air already. The Own the Podium program, which I believe was about $110 million investment in trying to get Canadian athletes to win the medal race and to win some gold medals, which they finally did on their home soil. These Olympics, but I agree with what the emailer says. When it comes down to it, we are all tribal, and the Olympics brings that out, and we all want to we kind of say it quietly. Some of us say it quietly. I think a lot of fans here have no problem. The ones at the moguls the other night when it was pouring rain and they had their shirts off and they had red, white, and blue painted on their chest. I don't think they had any problems with that. But others try to be circumspect and say, let's be dignified about this. But no, it's all about your country getting the most medals. And all these countries are dedicated to that.
Sure see that the Chinese are developing a curling program in an effort to burnish their medal totals at the Winter Games. Let's get another caller in. David with us. David calling from Boston.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment that I thought it was very objectionable of NBC to show the footage of the young loser who died. I was watching it with my children, and I knew what was coming up, so I turned it off, waited a few minutes, but when we turned it back on, they were still showing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should have left that on the web where people can look at it if they want, sort of like pornography, and not to force it on primetime TV.
And what was your interest in it?
Well, it was one of the first things that was shown. It was the first 10 minutes of their broadcast for the Olympics. And they went straight to it. And we knew it was coming up, so we turned it off. Because our kids are small and, nobody wants to see this.
Mm-hmm.
If this was like a snuff movie, basically, this poor child who died. And
David, did they offer any warning before they did this?
I don't think they did, actually. I mean, they might have mentioned something, but even then they should just have the dignity to say that this is what happened, we're not going to show it because this is a real person who died. And that they should have said, if you want to watch it, it's available on the web, and left it at that.
Winter sports inherently dangerous, though, David.
That's true, but, one of the things that nobody mentioned is that they are inherently dangerous, but we do put up barriers around the skiers so that if they slip and fall, they don't go into a tree. And this run was not well enough protected for that young man or any of the other people. The idea that it was his fault is totally objectionable. The fact that he qualified for the Olympics tells us that he was a outstanding athlete and he should never have been allowed to die from a simple error that he made going down a slope.
And he reportedly had, I believe, about 20 training runs on that track. I'm
correct.
Tend to agree.
And actually, the Canadians have had several hundred because of this Own the Podium thing where they limited access. And that's really something that should also be considered.
David, thanks very much.
Okay.
Right. Bye-bye.
We're hearing, Neil, that Sochi, in Russia, the site of the next Winter Olympics are definitely taking into account what happened here and building a luge track, you know, with safety in mind. We hope.
It's day 7 of the 2010 Winter Games. We'll talk more with Tom Goldman in Vancouver in a moment. And your calls. What's your biggest moment, your biggest complaint about the Games thus far? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Back to the Olympic Games in just a moment, but we're following an important story here at NPR News today out of Austin, Texas, where a small plane crashed into an office building today. That building houses local offices of the IRS. NPR's John Burnett is in Austin and has been following the story and joins us on the phone. John, thanks very much.
I'm happy to be here, Neil.
Our authorities are trying to determine if this crash was intentional or an accident. Has that been confirmed either way?
The authorities are still not confirming whether this individual flew his Piper Cherokee into the office building intentionally, but things that that journalists are learning on the web are telling us otherwise.
And that is an apparent suicide note, which includes a long rant against,
right,
among other things, the IRS.
And of course, this is also unconfirmed, but it seems to be valid that this individual, Joseph Stack, who's a pilot registered here in Austin, had this long diatribe against the U.S. government and the IRS in particular. And I'll quote just a little bit of it. I'm finally ready to stop this insanity. Well, Mr. Big Brother IRS man, let's try something different. Take my pound of flesh and sleep well. Signed, Joseph Stack, 1956 to 2010.
And it was dated today.
Correct.
It should be mentioned that, as I understand from wire service accounts of this letter, there are a little hard to pin him down ideologically. He mentions George W. Bush by name, but also President Obama's policies, too.
Right. And to tell you the truth, I've been out here on the scene where this building is still smoldering, Neil, and I've been trying to sort of get the facts straight here on the ground. So I haven't read everything that's on the web. But one of the things they stress here in Northwest Austin, the police chief, Art Acevedo, was very emphatic that this was not an act of terrorism, and citizens locally and nationally don't need to be afraid. And they've turned the power on around this area, and the fire is out as you and I speak. It's just smoldering now. But it's a pretty nasty hole in this building.
They're calling it an isolated incident. In other words, don't expect anything else to be associated with it. What do we know about casualties?
Well, remarkably, when you look at the gaping hole and that this this small plane, single-engine plane, left in this five-story smoky black glass building, you would have thought that it would have been catastrophic. Here it was 10 o'clock in the morning. Office workers were there in their cubicles. And yet, at the moment, we know that there are two people who've been taken to hospitals here in Austin and one in San Antonio with burns. And there is one other worker unaccounted for. And there are unconfirmed reports that Mr. Stack, the pilot, is dead.
NPR's John Burnett, thanks very much. John, we'll let you get back to work.
Happy to be here.
John Burnett joining us by phone from Austin, Texas. Obviously, we're going to continue to bring you any updates on this story as we get them. And stay tuned to NPR News and later today, All Things Considered, for the latest developments. This hour, though, we're focusing on the 2010 Winter Games in Vancouver, British Columbia. And let's get back to Tom Goldman in Vancouver, NPR sports correspondent covering the Winter Games. Like most years, you can't talk about the Games without talking about, a lot of other things, too. We're hoping that you will call us with your favorite, greatest moments and biggest complaints about the Vancouver Games. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Let's go next to Ron, and Ron's calling us from Augusta in Georgia.
Well, I sorry, I'm a little choked up over the Austin, Texas.
It's a terrible story. Yeah,
America was up to those people. it's a crazy world. Anyway, all I was wanting to add was I myself enjoy the sidebar. I live here in Augusta where we have the Masters every year. And to go to the Masters, it's a wonderful experience, but you can hardly see anything for the crowds. It's, you know, you're back behind X number of rows, or maybe you go get a bleacher earlier and you see them come through one hole. And whereas all the sidebars and the slow-mo, you get the story of what these athletes have been doing in the past 4 years since the past Olympics, things that I wouldn't know anything about. And it for me, it endears me more to the athletes, and you can't beat a long-lens camera as far as a front-row seat. You know, come down, you know, the slopes. And like the long performance night in the men's skating, it's just I wouldn't have known all these stories that are going on, you know, within the community. But
Ron, a lot of people would envy you the chance of going to the Masters every year anyway, even to be in that crowd. But
Well, it's fun to be there. But when Phil won his first Masters, I was so far away. I heard the cheer, and everybody was hugging one another. But I had to watch the replay on
on TV. Right. Thanks very much. Here's an email from Peter in Minneapolis. The Winter Olympics seem to be turning into the X Games by including events like ski cross, snowboard cross, and snowboard halfpipe. Has this brought a wider audience? Do you see this trend continuing? Tom Goldman, I did glance at the Nielsen ratings yesterday, and, well, the Winter Olympics are all over it, including the opening ceremony at number one.
Doing well, yeah. I mean, I think Peter may have something there. I think they are expanding, certainly, interest. As we talked about earlier, if they'd include women's ski jumpers, they'd expand it even more. But it's, I think these games, and these games in particular, have been generating a lot of attention, not always for good reasons, but, and that's interesting because heading into these games after the Beijing games, which were so transcendent and so huge, not just for a spectator, but for a journalist, it had everything to it. And the feeling was kind of like, oh, Canada, what's going to happen with this one? Because winter games are generally, you know, on a smaller scale. But I think there's been a lot that's generated interest. I think, as I said, maybe on the show last week, you know, how the Olympics reinvent themselves every day. And so far, there's been an interesting story or five every day from these Olympics.
There have been some snafus as well, going back to that opening ceremony where one of those supports for the cauldron failed to rise on cue. And there's been a problem with the electric ice cleaning machine, not a Zamboni, but a rival company manufactured that. And they had to fly some Zambonis in to actually get the ice clean.
Yeah, and let's not forget the fence, Neil. The fence. The best headline I've seen in the newspaper up here is this fence that was obstructing the view of people who wanted to come see the cauldron and the flame, the Olympic flame, outside. There was a chain link fence up for security reasons, and the headline said, "Mr. Furlong, who's the head of the Vancouver Organizing Committee, tear down that fence." And so they did, kind of. The Vancouver Organizing Committee was responsive. They moved the fence closer to the cauldron. They've cut a little rectangle in it so people can actually take pictures through it without having chain link superimposed over their photo. And they put in a rooftop viewing area so people can go up on a building close by and look down on it. You still can't go up and touch it. A lot of concern about the protesters, and we've had some stories on our air from Martin Costi about this. Very vocal protesters, and they've gotten violent too, and I think organizers are perhaps a little spooked by that, and they feel like if they took down that fence, tore down that fence, that there might be some actual problems with the cauldron and the flame, even if security people were there.
We spoke earlier about the men's figure skating, the long program tonight. That's the decisive event. Well, it's perennially one of the most anticipated events at the Winter Olympics. Eyes glued to the TVs tonight and to the skaters' flashy and often sparkly costumes. They don't, at least theoretically, contribute to the judging of the event. Nevertheless, skaters are certainly judged on their outfits by the audience. Joining us now is Hank Stuver, style reporter for The Washington Post, with us at the studio at the newspaper. Hank, always nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And the costumes, well, they seem to be wilder every year, and this year's no exception.
Yeah, Tuesday night in the short program, there was that wonderful Norwegian skater who had this was wearing a skeleton. He was in black with white bones. They're more inventive. They're more flashy. Johnny Weir came out with his cute little pillow. You know, it's funny. They seem to be baiting us, you know, to there was a guy in overalls. He looked like a farmer. You know, they're trying different things, obviously. You know, and it's so fraught, you know, being a male figure skater, being, you know, this every 4 years we have this discussion. It makes our culture, especially American culture, it makes us very uncomfortable around ideas of masculinity, gender, athleticism, and, you know, our typical immature response is, that's so gay.
Yes, indeed. And as you look at these, you know, in theory, they could all be wearing identical outfits and the judging should be no different. That is not the way it works out, is it?
No, and I think that there are a lot of people in who watch figure skating probably only once every 4 years and think, why not just have them in black silhouette, you know, black onesies? That way they can focus on their skating. You know, but the history of figure skating is a big bundle of neuroses about the masculinity of the male figure skater. And so, you know, the solution seems to have been to embrace the showmanship, to bring out the glitter. But, you know, it is evolving. I mean, they all used to look like they were about to perform a cabaret on a cruise ship. And you know, now they've evolved. I mean, you see trousers and belts and shirts and you know, it would be nice someday to see one just skate out in a very nice suit, you know, and do Mad Men on Ice, you know.
Some of these outfits are so elaborate, you wonder if they get in the way.
Well, technically they don't, because they've certainly tried and rehearsed in them to make sure that there will be technical issues. They do get in the way of trying to get an every 4 year audience to accept figure skating as a sport. Certainly, I mean, the theatrics and the drama of figure skating are the very things that repel some potential fans, I would bet.
Well, on the other hand, a lot of these figure skaters competing in the Olympic Games are also extremely well-paid tour in terms of their touring, and they go even more extreme in those events.
Right, right. I mean, to them, you know, the Olympics turns out to be this solemn anti-fashion, anti-creativity event or world competitions. All a preamble to Campbell's Stars on Ice, you know, so where they can really cut loose and be themselves. Although, you know, none of them are actually really being themselves. You know, my amateur hack psychologist theory is, you know, you're trying something very, very difficult while standing on blades on a very slippery surface. It's just one big metaphor for all of our issues around gender and masculinity, and of course you're going to slip and fall. You're ridiculous.
You're talking with Tom Goldman of NPR News and Hank Stuver of The Washington Post. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Tom, I heard you trying to break in there.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the costume that we're paying close attention to from kind of a news angle, other than Johnny Weir's, because he always surprises us with neat costumes, is the Russian ice dancers, Domnina and Shabalin, who created this firestorm of protest when they did what they call an Aboriginal dance in their original program, and offended a lot of people, particularly in Australia. And their costumes, I mean, Hank can you know, kind of confirm or deny this, but their costumes basically make them look like cavemen. And I think there is some talk that maybe they're going to have to tone it down. They can't change their program at this point, and they'll still skate, you know, the same moves and the same music. But I think there's talk that they're going to change their costume.
They can be adequately punished by having to wear the black onesie.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Mark's calling from New Britain in Connecticut.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to contribute that I think that the straight guys who are sort of squirming in their seats looking at the male figure skating costumes kind of have something to learn, because all of my female friends watching this are saying, oh, my God, that's so hot.
Really?
that all of my female friends think these costumes are incredibly, incredibly sexy. And just it's that, I hate to use the word, but fabulous looking.
Well, it's very interesting. I expect we're going to see the hockey players carrying pillows out to the game tomorrow.
Right. Personally, I thought Evan Lysacek's Raven suit was really striking. That was my winner for the night. But, all my female friends were saying how hot they all were.
All right, Mark, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Evan's Raven suit is especially instructive because he has worked very hard to present himself as the masculine antidote to Johnny Weir. And his designers have worked very hard to walk a very fine line between, you know, they've added some flourish to that black outfit with some feathering, but he to me sort of symbolizes the neuroses that the sport has about how it's perceived.
And I wonder, does the designer, there is an entourage around each of these skaters, of course. There are people, choreographers, trainers, and as you suggest, designers. Do they? How important are they in a skater's retinue?
Very. There's a documentary on Sundance currently about Johnny Weir's, some days in the life of Johnny Weir. And certainly the fitting and the design and his very long relationship with the woman who constructs his costumes for him is important. Other skaters have turned to designers such as Vera Wang to come up with the answer that gets them out of sort of the ice capades glitter and into something that's more fashion forward but can stand up to the routine.
And Tom, of course, the more they're part of the conversation when they go to that that tour, and it'll be soon at a rink near you, that gets them, well, maybe more fans.
Oh, I'm sure it does, absolutely. And you know, we're talking about Johnny Weir. I think, the fur watch is over. I think no more fur. Is that correct, Hank? Because of the...
We've heard, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. Because of the anti-fur activists who have been threatening Johnny Weir. So.
Well, also that caveman problem.
The caveman problem.
Kidding.
I thought you were going to go with triple axel so easy a caveman can do it.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if they would all skate better if the sport could be more open about the athletes themselves. We all know, or at least we all pretend to know, that some of these male figure skaters have had to keep their sexuality in the closet. And to me, that neurosis is completely expressed in the ability to do something until everyone is watching, and then you slip and fall. I wonder if they would be healthy and more fully expressed if they were fully expressed.
Hank Stuver, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hank Stuver, style reporter for The Washington Post, with us today from their studios here in Washington, D.C. Tom Goldman, thank you there in Vancouver. Have a great time.
Neil, a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. And when we come back from a short break, obviously stay tuned to NPR for further developments on the story out of Austin, Texas. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.